I've been reflecting a little bit further on last week's talky bit, and the experience of feeling like someone without a spiritual home state. And as I've reflected on that this week, I've been reminded about how dark some parts of that experience can feel. And my own experience at this stage in my personal journey is that there is a treasure in that darkness that isn't found any other place or any other way. And the more time I spend there, the more I wouldn't trade it for the world. But I also know that my own journey would suggest to me that there's no shortcut to that treasure. And that moving in that direction means moving in the dark. I may restate this as we go. I don't want us to miss this point. We use the language of darkness for lots of different things, including many of the experiences of wrestling with our mental health. And this morning, when I use that language, that is not what I'm talking about. Sometimes those things are very hard to tease out from one another. Spiritual darkness, let's say, or the sense of spiritual statelessness, as we talked about last week. Feeling adrift. Those things can overlap with things that are discernibly about our mental health. And so I realize that's a complicated space, but I wanted to sort of say something about that distinction right off the top. I would add, having said what I've said about traveling in the dark leading to treasures that you can't find any other way, I would want to add to that that my own experience of traveling in the dark has been that it's quite a different matter for me to do that than it is for me to watch my kids do that. I have adult kids, not just adult kids, but more than not. And so that's an age and stage experience as well, I realize. But I've found it way harder to watch my kids venture into this terrain than it's been to go there myself. Even though, and that's still true, even though I would no longer think of that space and experience as something that I should try to deny or try to avoid. Even though that's true, it's still hard to watch my kids go there. And I think for lots of us in this community, I know that one of the really achy parts of our own spiritual exploration has been, maybe it continues to be, some real agonizing about how to help our kids either understand or maybe even enter into something that has taken us to what we might call dark places. So what I wanted to do this week was just reflect a little bit, just muse out loud a little bit about what might we tell the kids about traveling in the dark. For some of us, this will be very literal. You know, we're thinking of our kids and our voice and their listening and their life experience. For some of us, it can be a metaphor. But I think there's something here for everybody. Our household are pretty big fans of the old television sci-fi series Firefly, which died a premature death. We're not going to get into it, but there you go.
Amen.
See?
Yeah.
Right. I suspected as much. Now, the next line of my notes says that that show is probably relatively obscure at this point, but not to everyone in the room, clearly. In our house, it gets rewatched at least once a year, in its entirety, including the movie. I'm not going to nerd out on it. But what first came to mind when I thought about the dark was actually the way the dark is referenced in that series. In Firefly, the dark is most often used as a word for space. For deep space in particular, for the parts of the universe we might otherwise think of as a vacuum. It's used to describe a space that would be understood to be uninhabitable by humans without technological assistance. It's a synonym for danger. It's a synonym for lost, and it's a synonym for vulnerable. It's a synonym for unfathomable. It's the dark, the way we might have experienced it when our parents tucked us in, if that was an experience we had, and then turned out the light and closed the door when we were kids. It's the dark as fearsome. It's the dark as a place to be avoided. It's the dark as something that should be driven back by the light. Now, if you're a Firefly fan, you might already be disagreeing with me, because it's also used in that series as a metaphor for a place of adventure and discovery. A place where the truly adventuresome go to get away from the people who are trying to codify everything. More on that in a minute. For some of us, the dark is, in spiritual terms, a metaphor for spiritual lostness. It's the kind of language we might use when we feel abandoned by the divine. Sometimes it's also language that we use for what our mental health struggles can feel like, a dark place. I think that's a topic, as I mentioned earlier, all on its own. There's lots of overlap, but that's not what I'm going to explore this morning. When I think about all of that, it seems to me that one of the first things I want to tell the kids about traveling in the spiritual dark is that it's worth reconsidering what the dark can stand for. And I know that my experience with that idea has been that reconsidering the dark can be a pretty hard thing to do. It's a very hard idea to entertain. We're surrounded by the other metaphor, dark bad, light good. It's just common parlance for those ideas. And in my own experience, frankly, I don't think I would have been able to, I don't think I would still be able to reconsider what the dark might mean without some help. And there'd be a few different ways I could illustrate this, but this one's fresh for me, so this is the path I chose. I've been very privileged over the years to enjoy a rich friendship with singer-songwriter Steve Bell. And it's an interesting experience for me, because although I have real love for Steve as a friend, and I have enormous admiration for him as a musician, it's actually not his musical style that draws me in. I wouldn't describe myself as a folkie in terms of my magnetic north musically. But I would describe Steve as a folkie. I'm only sort of resonant with that style, and then I'm usually resonant with it when it tilts toward Americana, which isn't really Steve's vibe. But what really pulls me into Steve's art is the depths of his reflection on the big questions, and the way that he is able to put poetics around those questions that don't, in such a way that they don't box me in. To me, that's the nugget. That's the heart of Steve's gift as a singer-songwriter. I spent 5.5 years working full-time with him, during which time that whole let's do concerts with symphony orchestras thing happened in his career. And so I've had the chance over the years to produce 30-some of those shows for him all over Canada and the US. And it's been an incredible experience for me to sit in the middle of some of this country's best orchestras and feel those songs. I don't even have goosebumps. So I don't know how to describe what that feels like. One of my favorites in lots of those shows is a piece of Steve's called The Dark Night of the Soul, which is based on John of the Cross's book-length poem by the same name. As soon as you say the phrase book-length poem, not to worry. I'm just a little disclaimer. We're not going to read the poem. Okay? I know I like poetry and it's all that stuff, but not, don't sweat it. Book-length, actual book-length poem. Which is, and for those of us who kind of dig these sorts of things, it's an enduring work of Christian mysticism. I mean, it's still around, and it was a long time ago. We'll talk about that in more detail in a bit. But I sometimes wonder, when I think about spiritual dark and what it has become to me, I sometimes wonder if it's been my repeated exposure to some of the ideas of John of the Cross's poem, as expressed by Steve's song, and as experienced viscerally by being in the midst of these orchestras playing this particular arrangement of the song, that's actually been the fuel for my ongoing personal reconsideration of the dark. I know it's been important. I'm not sure how you measure these things, but I know it's been important. A little bit about John of the Cross might help us kind of get inside the ideas, both of the poem and of the song, a little bit more readily. And just a reminder, so we don't lose track in all of this, I'm still thinking about what we might say to our kids about all of this And we probably won't be quoting John of the Cross to them. So just stay with me for a bit. There's a reason why we're spending some time in this part of what we're doing, okay? I think it's worth being aware that John of the Cross began writing this poem during an 11-month confinement to a monastery prison. Is that a functioning oxymoron? I've had a chance to visit some of the great collections of monasteries in Europe, including a remarkable one in Greece, where all these monasteries are built on top of columns of rocks, and there's kind of this whole collection of them in this one area. That's interesting enough and well worth visiting, but if you go to visit this particular collection of monasteries, one of the places you will drive by every time you're driving up to one of them, it's unlabeled, but it's a huge scar in one of these rock faces, is the monastery prison, which is just this labyrinthian vertical cave where the monks imprisoned people. Now, in this particular case, the monks imprisoned a monk. Not that unusual, interestingly enough. So, John of the Cross starts to write Dark Night of the Soul when he's in monastery prison. He's not in prison for some heinous moral failure or some violation of monastic vows. He's in prison for something I think most of us would have been cheering for. What happens, this is like mid-1500s, is together with Teresa of Avila, another mystic whose work has survived and is resident in the 21st century West, together with Teresa of Avila, to whom he was mentored, they founded the Monastery of St. Joseph. This is 1562. And the reason they found this monastery is because they feel like the monastic world has become corrupt. And it's become kind of this haven for wealth and power. And in fact, in the monastery where Teresa was situated, there were these huge suites of rooms where the wealthiest of the nuns lived with staff and servants, and like they just kind of moved in lock, stock, and barrel. So just huge collections of wealth and power, sort of sheltered by the religious structures of the church from common life. And Teresa and John looked at this and went, that doesn't seem like the original idea. We should get back to the original idea. And so they wanted to found a monastic order where life together was about simplicity and silence and solitude, the things that a mystic practice are still about. And it succeeded, which did not go unnoticed by their religious superiors, who are actually kind of from go, gently opposed to this whole idea, and then when it started to work, you know, more vigorously opposed to it. So 4 years after they found this monastery in 1562, John has by this point quit his job, and he's become the spiritual director of the convent part of that order. 4 years in, his religious superiors order him to quit, to leave that position as spiritual director, and he refuses. So this makes him an outlaw inside of his own order. The night of December the 2nd, 1577, a bunch of men break into John's rooms at the convent. They abduct him and another friar who's in those rooms. They blindfold them, they bind them, they lead them to another monastery where they beat them. They deny them access to sanitary conditions. They feed them bread and water. They don't permit them to leave their cells except for what's called circular discipline, which basically means being flogged by other monks. And then after 2 months of that, John is put into solitary confinement where the only literal light he sees, and this is important to his metaphor, the only literal light that he sees comes in through this little slit in the wall. And that is where he starts to compose Dark Night of the Soul. First of all, he has no access to writing resources, so first of all, he starts to compose it just by remembering it all in his head. He just memorizes it all. And then eventually some kind jailer starts to sneak him some writing supplies, and he starts to write the ideas down. He's in solitary confinement for 9 months. I don't know if anybody's been paying attention to the news stories about what solitary confinement is and does and how we're trying to adjust our own penal system in this regard. 9 months in solitary confinement, we don't even have good language for what that can do to a human being. After 9 months of this, he escapes, goes to the south of Spain, reforms the order. There's less threat of persecution. He's got a little more distance from the powers that be in Rome. And he keeps on writing down what he feels like he learned in the dark. And this is where I think the story gets even more interesting. I would think, that given that history, right? That given that experience, that the book, Dark Night of the Soul, would probably be a memoir about how John of the Cross got through this truly awful part of his life by hanging on to his faith in God, no matter what happened to him. You know, kind of a survivor memoir. You might think, in terms of what shall we tell the kids, that the message from John of the Cross would be, just don't abandon your belief system, and it'll work out for you in the end. You'll break out and experience new freedom. Just don't abandon your belief system. But it's not. That's actually not what the poem's about. In the first place, John of the Cross doesn't really have very much to say about religion. He doesn't write about religion in this poem. What he writes about is about passions and about the senses. Very human, core human experiences. For him, the Dark Night is actually a love story. Now, the love in it is oxymoronic. It's painful joy, but it's the painful joy that we experience by seeking what John would call the most elusive lover of all. That's John of the Cross's reference. Now, John of the Cross is also not someone to read if you want to read someone that's going to help you get a better grip on God, because as he tells it, one of the most important lessons of the Dark Night is that God is not a thing to be grasped. Spanish, the language he's writing in, his first time. John's word that he chooses for God in Dark Night of the Soul is nada. Nothing. God is a no thing. God is a not a thing in Dark Night of the Soul. And since God is not a thing, God cannot be held onto, but only encountered as that which eclipses the reality of all other things. For John of the Cross, that transforms the dark from being a fearsome thing to a place of hope and of transformational love. In his song, Interpreting and Interacting with the Poem, Steve puts it this way. I bless the starless night, a night by far more lovely than the dawn. Oh, happy chance to discover in the barren dark the one I knew so well. A night by far more lovely than the dawn, Steve? What were you thinking? That's a serious reconsideration of the dark. And it makes me want to tell my kids and any kids that I have reach for, the spiritual dark is not a place where you are abandoned by love. It is a place where you can encounter love like nowhere else. Now, if we're so inclined, we could substitute the word God for the word love. But we need to do that with some real care, because many of us have grown up in religions that have specialized in teaching us what God is. And John is saying that our positive statements about God, God is statements, mostly trick us into accepting some half-baked notions about the divine as though they were, those notions were the real thing. He suggests that our images of God are the obstacles that get in the way of us encountering the real. The dark, to John of the Cross, is where familiar and sometimes comforting things like religious concepts, theological language, codified morality get stripped away, and love finally has a chance to do what it does best, which is be with us heart to heart. And what I want to tell the kids is that there is nothing more worth pursuing than love, and that there is nothing that will enliven the dark more or that will keep you alive in it longer. Way back when I was getting my own theological education underway, there was a book kicking around by a writer named James Fowler called Stages of Faith. Some of you may have encountered that book. Fowler suggests that most faith formation can be understood in terms of some definable stages, sort of a zenith of let's turn the mysteries into stages, sort of the same chunk of thinking that gave us Kubler-Ross's stages of grief, for example. Useful ideas, to be sure. Now, whether we like that idea that faith can be divided up into definable stages or not, I think there's some insight that's available from it. So, just a brief moment with Mr. Fowler. Fowler's stages outline the early development of the thing we use a word like faith for this way. He suggests that it starts out with this fantasy-filled imitative faith of early childhood. I don't know if you've ever heard little kids talk about God, but I think Fowler nailed this one. Then it moves to sort of the more literal faith of school children. If God is everywhere, that's where we get the "I don't see him" questions, right? The conventional, largely inherited faith of early adolescence, followed by the individuated faith of early adulthood. And I would suggest that in my experience working with university students, which I do a fair bit, that the individuated faith of early adulthood is a sliding scale, probably measured reasonably by the same definition by which we are talking about the end of the stage of adolescence. So the number for when adolescence ends, from a psychological point of view, keeps moving down. It keeps getting higher. And I think individuated faith is connected to that. Fowler would say that that's where lots of folks stop. And with this individuated faith of late adolescence, early adulthood. But he goes on from there with the model. He delineates a couple more stages. And if you're reading Fowler, you'll realize that the further he gets past that, the more trouble he has with language. Like, he just starts to have more and more trouble defining those subsequent stages. But he includes a fifth stage in the model where he talks about people experiencing the undoing of a lot of certainties about themselves and the worlds they worked so hard to put in place around themselves. And in the process of talking about those further stages, those fourth and fifth stages, Fowler offers some definitions of terms that I found really helpful, and I hope we all will. In particular, he distinguishes between, and this is the part that was intriguing to me in this context of walking in the dark, he distinguishes between religion and faith and belief. So in the 16th century, now we're talking about John of the Cross kind of terrain, historically, in Western history, European history in particular. So in the 16th century, to believe meant to set the heart upon, or to give the heart to, as in, I believe in love. Okay, so 16th century, that's what believe means. And then in the centuries that followed, so we got the Enlightenment that happens in there, and then in the centuries that follow the Enlightenment, what happens is everyday use of words like belief and belief starts to change. And in that period of Western history of thought, those words and phrases start to reference the way we arrange the furniture in our heads rather than in our hearts. So what I believe starts to mean what I think about something and how I think about it. Okay, so this is kind of what happens post-Enlightenment to that language. And then, by the 19th century, we're kind of into this period of Western thought where knowledge consists largely of, or at least desirably of, empirical facts. That's what we know are the facts. Everything else is something else. So when we get to that stage in the history of this stuff, knowledge is mostly empirical facts. So by now, what's happened to belief is that belief has become the opposite of knowledge. That's quite a journey from what I set my heart on to the opposite of what I know. And so what happens is that you get this conflation, right? So a person's belief in God is reduced to their belief system, which by that point in history basically consists of statements of faith that the person judges to be true but cannot prove. Anybody ever heard this conversation or had this conversation inside of themselves or outside of themselves? You believe what about God? Well, can you prove it? That's these ideas at work, right? So as Fowler puts it, though, the real pity of that conflation is that when faith is reduced to belief in creeds and doctrines, lots of thoughtful people are going to decide that they no longer need faith. Why would you need a collection of unprovable beliefs? Actually, if we heard the word faith used to describe trust or loyalty in something beyond the self, which is basically the way we use the word spiritual these days. If we heard the word used that way, we might still find it useful. But when faith is equal to belief in a set formula of theological truths, we check out. If the set formula of theological truths is no longer something we can adhere to, we talk about losing our faith. But what if we took a word like faith as being the word we would use to address questions like, what is my heart set on? What power or powers do I rely on most? What's the hope that gives meaning to my life? Those, I'm going to suggest, are questions of faith, not questions of belief. They're the kind of questions that I think Augustine might have had in mind when he wrote, if you have understood, then what you have understood is not God. You've understood, then what you've understood is not God. And what I want to say to the kids, I haven't lost track of them in all of this, what I want to say to the kids is, don't be afraid of your questions. And don't be afraid of the passions of your heart. You have, we have, I have those things as ways of freeing us from the things that might keep us from the real thing. They end run this inclination to have belief be about the way we arrange the furniture of ideas in our minds and instead have it be about what we trust with our hearts. Maybe, in terms of what I want to say to the kids, what we should do is just take away the word thing entirely. Maybe what I want to say to the kids is, accept no substitutes. Set your heart on the real. Set your heart on the real. Barbara Brown Taylor, who I think writes brilliantly about these things, in a little bit of an earlier book of hers called Learning to Walk in the Dark, summarizes John of the Cross's take on all of this way. She writes, the dark night is God's best gift to you, intended for your liberation. It is about freeing you from your ideas about God, your fears about God, your attachments to all the benefits you have been promised for believing in God, your devotion to the spiritual practices that are supposed to make you feel closer to God, your dedication to doing and believing all the right things about God, your positive and negative evaluations of yourself as a believer in God, your tactics for manipulating God, and your sure cures for doubting God. The dark night exists to free us from those things and leave us alone with the real. Sometimes we get into this kind of terrain, our language kind of breaks down. And maybe that feels especially true if the language we're familiar with or our default language was religious language, kind of these big, hard to define theological terms. They're full of human, thoughtful substance, but sometimes they can feel really devoid of connection to the divine. Now, I don't know if you've ever had the privilege of talking with someone that has lost a lot, but says they wouldn't trade that experience for whatever it was that they lost. Tend to be a little bit baffling experiences to us if we're still in pursuit of trying to buffer ourselves in whatever way. But people in those kind of conversations tend to talk about being a part of what they saw. They realize that they're part of what they were seeking, that it's all connected. That things like the things that we tend to think about ourselves as being separate from, they're kind of like, I realized I was no longer separate from that. And things seemed more real than I could ever imagine them to be, even though they had lost so much of the things that we tend to think of as real. It's like they're trying to describe a place where things like light and dark, like faith and doubt, like divine presence and absence, they're not opposites, but they actually exist within and with each other. It's like the things we look at as opposites aren't. It's like trying to describe the relationship between waves and the ocean. If you're standing on the beach, the waves roll in, you go, yep, there's wave one, there's wave two, there's wave three. Hey, look, there's a pattern. Every third wave, there's a big one. If you're a surfer, you pay attention to these things. Look at that, all these waves, I can name them, like wave one, two, three. And then they roll back out. And then if I stand back and I stop counting the waves, I go, that's the ocean. It's all the ocean. The waves are distinct from one another, but they come from and they return to the same source. At some point, you know, like all the analogies and illustrations fail, right? And I think in ways that are age appropriate and tailored to each of our kids' journeys and to each of ours, I want to say to the kids, when that happens, when your system of belief or your parents' system of belief fails, don't try to rein it in. Don't try to recover it. Just take a deep breath and go for a walk in the dark. Because that's where love becomes real.